A wit once said that if a story doesn't feature a dead mule, it isn't Southern fiction. Although there are some dead horses in News Stories from the South, 2007, the year's best, there are no dead mules. And as we might expect from the contemporary South, there are stories about bikers and farmers, Bauhaus-loving goths, and basketball coaches. Edward P. Jones edited the collection, which is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Jones back to the show, along with Joshua Ferris, who is one of the book's contributors. Hello. Hello.
Greetings.
Mr. Jones, I've heard that you were initially hesitant to edit this book. Why?
Yeah, well, part of it, a small part of it, was just I didn't think I had enough time. You know, I was very busy. And another part of it was, the great part of it was a reluctance to judge anyone and say who should be in and who should not be in. But I've had a good relationship with Algonquin Books, with that particular anthology. So ultimately I said yes and was happy to do so.
You grew up in Washington, D.C., the city you set most of your short stories in. Is Washington a city of the South?
They say it is. I've never considered it, you know, one way or another, I suppose. What I do know is that most of the adults that I grew up with had been born and raised in the South, and what they passed on to me was Southern tradition, Southern culture, and so I suppose in that sense maybe it is a Southern city.
Well, even more so, Washington was a segregated city until fairly late in the game, and it was pretty much run by Southern congressman, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think to a certain extent it still is. They make a lot of the decisions still for the city.
Even though the city now has its own mayor and its own...
Well, that's about all it has. Few people know, of course, that they have no representation in Congress. There's a woman there, but she has no vote.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, Joshua, didn't you grow up largely in Chicago?
I did. I was born in a small town in Illinois and then went to high school in the suburbs of Chicago. So I have sort of a checkered geographical past.
So how did you come to identify yourself as Southern?
Well, I'm not sure that I do entirely. I did spend what I would consider the formative years of my life in Key West, Florida.
Mm. And is Key West typical of the South?
That's questionable, too. I mean, Key West is sort of an entity in and of itself. I kind of feel as if you need an entirely new passport just to get anywhere south of Miami. But it has certainly has some Southern elements to it. And then I spent some time in Pensacola, Florida, which is where we moved after we lived in Key West, and that's certainly a Southern.
Now, in the days when writers like Faulkner, O'Connor, Welty, Tennessee Williams, Robert Penn Warren were major literary figures, there was a lot of talk about Southern writing as something of a genre. We don't hear much of that anymore. Have things changed as the country has become more homogenized? Or are there just fewer writers writing about a Southern experience?
I think it's the latter. I mean, the stories in this anthology, for example, there are places in there that you know, if they didn't tell you that they were in the South, they would seem as if they were in the North.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I can no longer define what it is. You know, there's still people who write about the things that I grew up knowing as the South, the mules, for example, and farming and all of that.
Of course, there are farms all over the country.
Yeah, but there's something, there was always, especially with the literature I read, there was something special about Southern farms.
You've said, Josh, that maybe it isn't all the literature, although I don't know, maybe you've read all those writers, but it's also country music that creates some kind of literature of the South.
Well, I think in terms of my relationship with the South, I think that actually, something that Edward says in the introduction is that it's a matter of the heart. And when I think of the South and when I think of, you know, this kid that went to high school in the suburbs, as I said, of Chicago, which is as far from the South as you can get, or the University of Iowa.
Although an awful lot of people moved from the South to Chicago.
To Chicago, sure. And historically.
But mostly African Americans.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the suburbs are so... anesthetized to some extent that it's hard to think of the South when you think of the suburbs of Chicago. Mm-hmm. I think of going back to a place when I think of the South, a place of the heart and a place of the mind, and I can be transported there when I listen to the old songs that I grew up on, and those are country songs, and those songs are about the South and about Southern things.
So is a Canadian country singer like Hank Snow an honorary Southerner?
I would imagine, yeah. I would imagine he makes the cut.
My guests are Edward P. Jones and also Joshua Ferris. We're talking about new collection of stories, actually part of a series called New Stories from the South, this case 2007, which is edited by Edward P. Jones and published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Nabokov said that all Russian literature came from Gogol's overcoat. Does all of Southern literature come from Faulkner, do you think?
No, because they were doing a lot of things before Faulkner. And I didn't realize how rich the literature was until I got to graduate school and took a course. But no, I think since the first person ever stepped foot in the South and started writing, that's who we're descended from, whoever that person is.
And as you said in the introduction, this is a state of mind. It doesn't matter where you're living. So somebody like James Baldwin, let's say, who came, and there were other writers who came from Southern families but lived elsewhere. Are they still writing? Are they still Southerners because they're writing about a culture that they grew up with that's rooted in the South?
Yeah, with Baldwin, I'm trying to remember now if his parents, one or the other, came from the South. And if so, then I think probably yes, he inherits that. But I think that for...
I think Memphis, and his experiences in Harlem could just as easily have taken place in Memphis or Atlanta.
Yeah, because I think that when I was reading the Black literature people of the North, even something, for example, when I encountered Native Son, the people were in Chicago, but there was just this great undercurrent of Southerness about it. I knew these people. They were like the people I knew in Washington. And I think that comes from the fact that they all had these Southern roots.
We see that today with Walter Mosley, earlier with somebody like Chester Himes, who could write about L.A., even though I guess he came from the South and then moved to L.A., where... Yeah. Got into trouble. There were these enclaves that I'm sure white and black in various cities that out of the South that still maintained all sorts of Southern sensibilities.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned this in the introduction. I mean, you know, just about everything that I knew about life came from these people who had been born and raised in the South. You know, my whole outlook. I think if I had been born in New York City, for example, and had still been raised among the same people, I would have still been the same sort of person. I mean, I wrote one of the first story I ever got published was about a woman in the 1930s in the South. And that was based simply not on anybody that I knew, but I was able to use what I had learned about living in the South from the people around me, especially my mother.
So you didn't go there to do the research?
No.
It was the South of the mind, of the imagination.
Yeah. There's something that comes through when you live with those people, starting with my mother day after day after day. It gets in the blood.
Mm-hmm. Then it's interesting, there are some people like Truman Capote, who whose first book's about the South, but then from then on, he's very much a Northern writer.
Yeah, you get it out of your blood, I guess.
Well, and then there are people like Walker Percy, who I think of very much as a Southern writer, but he tried to do as much as he could to distance himself from being thought as a Southern writer, perhaps because he saw it as pigeonholing.
Yeah, I couldn't, of course, speak for him, but I guess, you know, there are those of us who want to carry it forever, and there's those of us who say, well, you know, I want to separate myself from all of that. I'm one of those people who love the South. Glad I am part of it, even though I wasn't really born in a place they can call the South.
And your award-winning novel takes place in the South. But did you go down to at least to research it before you wrote the book?
No, that was it. I mean, you know, I took 10 years avoiding all of the research, and at the end of it all, I had the book in my head, and I just had to start writing it. I think that had a lot to do with the fact that the creative side of my brain wanted to avoid all the research because it felt that if you did research, then the research would become paramount and not the characters in the story.
Actually, I just realized The Known World, the title of that novel, has some relevance to this discussion, don't you think? Because it's about the world that we know, even if we don't necessarily know it.
Yeah. Well, I think, the creativity carries you a long, long way. I mean, when I was writing that first story, and when I was writing the novel as well, I mean, all of this stuff had to be made up. Creating lies carries you quite far.
What about you, Josh?
I think that's an important thing to say, and that is that if a story is set in the South or about the South, I imagine that for the most part, a writer is primarily concerned with making that story work, not necessarily bringing forth some aspect of the South. That is not preeminent. What's preeminent is making sure that the story is effective in the way that the writer wants that story to be effective, and its setting or its particular trappings might be secondary to making sure that all of the craft is functioning on it with all its full cylinders.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's creating a woman out of clay, and if the anatomy of that woman isn't there, then you can frill her up with all the dress and hats and everything you want to. Yeah. But it still won't be a proper woman.
Yeah. Well, there are writers who insist on and when they're writing about a street, getting every house exactly right. And then there are writers like Martin Amis who says if he's writing about a part of London, let's say, that he hasn't been to in a while, he doesn't care whether he put the fish and chip shop in the right place or not. Yeah. There's got to be a fish and chip shop there somewhere.
Yeah, I would like to be able to myself to know that it's on the northeast corner rather than the northwest corner, so that's just for me. But I wouldn't take the bus over to find out.
My guests are Edward P. Jones, who's won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, the International Impact Dublin Literary Award, the Lannan Literary Award for his wonderful novel *The Known World*. He's also received a MacArthur. And his first collection of short stories, Lost in the City, won the Pen Hemingway, was shortlisted for the National Book Award. His most recent book is All Aunt Hagar's Children. And he is the editor of a collection called New Stories from the South, 2007, The Year's Best. It is published by Algonquin in a paperback edition. Also here is one of the contributors to that book, Joshua Ferris, and we'll talk a bit more about Joshua's story after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're talking about Southern literature today, which is quite different than it was in the past, as the country becomes very, as the strip malls appear all over the country. My guests are Joshua Ferris, who's a contributor to a new collection called New Stories from the South, 2007, published by Algonquin. And also here is Edward P. Jones, who edited the collection. There's a contributor, George Singleton, who says that in Greenville, South Carolina, he can visit a Confederate museum, which is an example of the Old South, a New York-style Whigs, the New South, and 47 Starbucks, which he says is the new South. Do you see those distinctions?
Well, when I go down to Pensacola, which is where my mother lives, I do see those distinctions. I mean, there are the 47, probably more than 47 Starbucks, and then there is the convenience store where you can get a plate of fried chicken and three sides for $1.99. And they have three buckheads over the refrigerators where the soft drinks are, and those sort of play off within, you know, a mile's radius of each other. So
how can they afford to serve so much for $1.99? The ingredients have to cost more than that, or are ingredients cheaper in Pensacola?
I don't think it's too terribly far from a plant or something, from a chicken plant, from a big.
I see.
So I imagine maybe transportation costs.
Well, they're picking up the scraps.
It might not be the best plate of fried chicken you can buy, but it'll do the job for a meal.
Well, one of the distinctions we often made in Southern writing is that there was a big gap between urban and rural. You think that still holds true?
No, I think, you know, as I said earlier, you know, there are places in the South now that are almost indistinguishable from places in the North. And I think probably you'd have to go far and wide in the South to find the kind of, you know, the flavors that I remember reading in stories and novels when I was growing up.
Who were you reading?
I'm not reading very many people nowadays because I'm...
No, I said, who were you reading, Southern writers?
I didn't discover Faulkner until I was in college. One summer I read about 10 Erskine Caldwell novels. Mm-hmm.
And he's probably one of the most, I think, one of the most underrated mm-hmm. writers, because everybody mm-hmm. thought of him as a sex writer.
That's it.
But mm-hmm. he was a pretty good writer about poor folks and farms. Yeah. I mean, he really and really got yeah. those people to come
yeah.
alive.
Yeah, I'll never forget that summer when I was able. They were paperbacks, about 10 cents each.
Mm-hmm. Capone. And when you read Gods of the Laker, did you think you were doing something illicit?
Well, they all came with drawings on the cover there, and in the midst of reading it, I would always take a gander at the cover.
Is that the reason you picked
the covers
one?
Were so
no,
sexy?
No, I don't know. I think they were cheap, you know. Yeah. And I was there was a summers when I was just reading every single thing I'd get my hand on.
Mm. Well, the covers always suggested that there was a lot more in the book than
was,
there really was.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was Erskine Caldwell?
Capote.
Other Voices, Other
Voices,
Rooms.
Other Rooms. The Tree of Night, The Stories.
Mm-hmm.
Hurry Sundown. I remember reading one summer was Mandingo.
Mm-hmm. But none of the great short story writers, Flannery O'Connor or...
No, I think a lot of them, for some reason, maybe it was the bookstore that I was going to, the used and the new bookstore, that they didn't really have those around. A lot of those people I discovered once I hit college.
I'd assume today that a young writer in the South, any part of the South, is as likely to be reading Garcia Marquez as William Faulkner.
Exactly. I think so.
Yeah. That, I mean, that might go back to your point about the homogenization. I mean, there are Barnes & Noble throughout the South, and so it's very easy to step in, and they're going to stock the same thing that they stock in any store in the North.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
And they're not going to stock the O.J. Simpson book, I gather. But that's a whole other matter. So tell us about your story, Joshua.
This story started when I was at the University of California, Irvine, in a graduate program. And I knocked my head against it for about 3 months, gave it up for dead, and then came back to it and made some changes, and it became the piece that is in there now. And it started basically because I wanted to sort of pay an homage to country music and my love of country music. When we moved down to Key West, I was eight or nine, and my mother played a tape, the same mixtape, over and over again, and it drove me absolutely crazy.
Who was on it?
Oh, some better known and some lesser known.
There were we talking Hank Williams? Or
yeah,
talking
there
about
was
more
some
recent
Hank Williams, but there was more like Willie Nelson and... Don Williams, who became a personal favorite of mine. A guy, I can't remember his name, but he sings a song, Baby's Got Her Blue Jeans On, which is a fantastic song. Johnny Paycheck. Some guys that are really canonical, but then sort of the lesser, you know, harder-hitting guys. Almost no women, for whatever reason. I don't know who made her this mixtape, probably my stepfather. And she played this mixtape over and over again. And then when I left to go back to Chicago, I missed my mom a great deal and realized that whenever I put those songs on, I had an immediate, reunion with her. And so that carried on through college and when I was listening to music that none of my friends would ever consider listening to, and decided that, you know, I wanted to employ it in some kind of work of fiction. And that's how it came. That was anyway the overall idea.
I think a black writer could do the same thing with Southern music that people rarely heard in the North, don't you think?
Yeah.
And also gospel music that would have been Southern-based, because there did seem to be a whole separate musical tradition there. Some of the Stax Vault stuff might filter north, but an awful lot of it stayed down there. And somebody like Ann Peebles would probably be barely known in the North, but were a big star in the South. Mm. So do you think that the music, the popular music, is a way of understanding what a place is all about? Because we don't have the same... you don't think of a lot of Northeastern music.
Yeah, I'm trying to think now the music that I grew up with. Not so much the blues, actually. Actually, a lot of the stuff came out of the North, Detroit and all of that.
Chicago and Detroit were the big...
Yeah, yeah. Because of the radio stations that we listened to, my mother, my sister, and I.
But many of those people had probably come up.
Yeah,
from the South. So much started down there.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's again, you know, almost all the people that I knew started out in the South. You know, mm-hmm. I think my generation was probably the first to be born in the North.
My guests are Edward P. Jones and Joshua Ferris. We're talking about Southern literature as inspired by a new collection called New Stories from the South, 2007, The Year's Best, published by Algonquin. Well, the South is a unique place. First of all, it has a stronger sense of its own history, perhaps, than other parts of the country. For a long time, people were more likely to stay there, or if they moved, to carry the South with them, whereas people from other parts of the country could, you know, somebody could be born in Albuquerque and then move to Salt Lake City and wind up in Los Angeles and didn't have a real sense of any region.
Yeah, it was a tradition when I was growing up that kids you sometimes spent the entire summer in the South with your relatives. Mm-hmm. It was just one of the things you did.
Well, how important was the fact that the South was the Confederacy for whites and blacks, do you think, and that sense of being different and creating a special kind of approach to literature?
Yeah, I didn't know much about the history of the South until I got into high school, even though, of course, I was reading a lot of fiction that touched on all of that.
But I can't read Faulkner without knowing about the Civil War.
I know, it's... And I don't know. I don't know if I had known all the history of it all, you know, beyond just the racism. I'm not sure if I would have taken to literature of the South the way I did. But as it was, I didn't know a whole lot, and so I was just reading for the pure enjoyment of it. But I think that's one of the things that for me has made the literature of the South so rich, is that you have these two people who have this odd and antagonistic history, and yet, you know, in so many ways they can't really be without each other, you know,
and they've affected each other's sense of culture.
Exactly Yeah, it's just one of you don't find it in the North. I mean, it's in the North, people are on one side of the city, on another side of the city, and they never really meet up.
Or if they do, if they live in integrated neighborhoods, that doesn't mean that you're going to hear something like Elvis Presley singing Sister Rosetta Tharpe songs, you know, which has happened in the South because everybody listened to everybody else's music, for example. In Aunt Hagar's Children, you write of a couple moving north. You said they shared stories about Southern places that would be the foundation of their lives in the North. Mm. None of them could know that cohesion born and matured in the South would be but memory in less than two generations.
And it is. And I think that's what, when I was growing up, everyone looked out for everyone else's children. You know, I remember my mother once worked in a restaurant at night, but our neighbors made sure that my sister and I were in bed at 9 o'clock. Now you read in the newspaper some child 13 years old is killed at, you know, 2 a.m. There was, I think, because they came from the South, they had a sort of common enemy, and they brought that cohesion with them to the South. And it lasted for one or two generations. But now, you know, all of that is gone, all that's lost. And the same thing, I think, for the people, black people in the South now. You wouldn't never think that they had, once upon a time, had ancestors who had a common enemy.
Can you imagine moving out of Washington?
I lived in Arlington, Virginia, across the river until 2004. Now and again, as I get older, I think, it doesn't have the same sort of hold on me anymore.
But living in what's the equivalent of a border city, and I would think that some of the places that you lived in the South are kind of border cities as well, although Pensacola has more of a deep South sensibility than the rest of Florida, doesn't it?
Yeah, very sort of Bible Belt.
That's in the Panhandle?
Yeah, it's in the Panhandle. Yeah.
And that's,
it's about an hour's drive from Mobile an hour's drive from Panama City, and just really very close to the border of Georgia.
But that is one of the interesting things about the South, that we can talk about, even earlier we talked about the strip malls, but even if you just look at what we call the South, we can go from rather a city like Atlanta, to a city like Macon. And we're talking about two very different cities in the same state.
That evoke a whole lot of different things, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that when you say the South, you evoke a certain thing. And then when you start to get a little bit more specific, you can see the subtle distinctions that arise from those, you know, distinctions, and the difference is considerable.
Well, how aware were you as somebody who had grown up in the North about all of the tensions that probably were happening around you, tensions and other and cultural tensions? And
I was very aware of them because it was a shock to go from where I was. I was in a very small town in Illinois, which I guess had some southern aspects, but Key West was such a dynamic place, and it has such a dynamic population.
But a lot of them are northerners, are people visiting, going there for their vacations.
Yeah, there are the tourists. I think that at the time that I was there, there were about 6,000 new tourists coming in every day during the weekends during tourism season. So it was a very dynamic place, but it does have its southern aspects. One of the things that I think of is that when you leave the South, even though there isn't, as you know, if you say there's this loss of generational loss of looking out after one another, one of the things that I've experienced, maybe as a person who passes as a northerner who doesn't have quite the southern roots that other people who have lived their whole life in the South, I will meet somebody from the South and have a kinship with them that would otherwise not be there if I had never spent any time in the South. So there's a kind of automatic...
There's a shared experience
that you can kind of fall into and talk about immediately, and it enriches that early relationship. Mm.
In editing this book and reading over all the stories, were you aware of that? Or are these stories... Could these just as easily be new American short stories?
I think probably, yes, that's true. I was fortunate that Kathy Porras first read everything, and then
she's a series editor.
Yes, and she selected what were Southern stories, and in many cases, she just sent along stories that took place in the South, you know, or touched on the South. So I was left just with the task of picking what I felt to be, you know, the best stories that were there. I didn't have to decide, well, this doesn't have enough of the Southern flavor. You know, this guy, even though this is in Georgia, really, it sounds too much like Indiana. I had to do was go by quality of work, you know, the artfulness of what was going on.
And that's what this book is, a collection of very fine short stories by a wide range of writers, some of them well-known, some of them less well-known. And two of them will be tonight, will be at McNally Robinson Bookstore, 52 Prince Street, Joshua Ferris, who's my guest here, along with Angela Threat, and, of course, Edward P. Jones, who is the guest editor of the collection, Pulitzer Prize winner, National Book Critics Circle Award winner, and everything else. It's been a great pleasure to have the both of you with us today.
Thank you.
Mine, too. Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's show, Michael Douglas tells us about his latest movie, King of California, then a documentary about Germany's reaction to an exhibit of the Wehrmacht's complicity in the Holocaust, plus how luxury goods have become a $157 billion industry, and Please Explain is all about over-the-counter pain relievers. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeshick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. And we had help today from Alexander Benaim, Rory Bernstein, Tanya Vita-King, Jennifer Keeney-Sindro, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.